Thanks for listening to another message from Life Christian Church. We hope it challenges and encourages you and helps you to grow in your faith. Don't forget, download our app to stay up to date with what's going on at Life, share your prayer requests or pray for others, read the Bible online and much, much more. Simply search for Life Christian Church in your app store. This series is called The Jigsaw Puzzle. And as we recognize, there is complexity in life. There are a whole bunch of pieces in life that sometimes seem to fit and sometimes don't seem to fit. And we try to navigate life the best that we can. But when it comes to God, the Bible tells us that God does have a plan and a purpose for each and every one of us. However, the mistake that we make when we're thinking about God's plan and purpose is that we think it's all about us. And we think it's like this first picture, which is like this completed masterpiece. And all the pieces just kind of lock in so beautifully together to create this beautiful picture. And unfortunately, if that's the image we hold, when it doesn't look like that, we're going to be all confused, we're going to be a bit disheartened, and at times we will come under self-condemnation or the condemnation of others, thinking, why doesn't my life look like that? And what I've been trying to encourage you with through this series is that that's not actually what life looks like. Life actually looks like this, that we are part of a much bigger plan and part of a much bigger purpose, that you and I are a piece of the jigsaw puzzle, as we see there, that if you take that in isolation, it's oddly shaped. It's not a terribly clear picture that's on the front of it. And we think, how do I make sense of this? And what I've been encouraging you to think about is the fact that this finds its context. This begins to make sense when we begin to plug into God's bigger picture. Does that make sense this morning? You see, when we ask the question, what is the will of God for my life? It's not the best question to ask because it actually puts us at the center of that question. What's the will of God for me? The question that we should be asking is, what is the will of God, full stop? What is the will of God, the bigger picture of which you and I are called to be a part? And it's that that helps us understand and helps things make sense, because at the center of the will of God is not us. At the center of the will of God is God. And you and I are invited by the creator of the universe to be drawn into and to engage in something that God is doing that predates our birth and will outlive us until Jesus returns. God is about his business, and right here and right now, we get to engage in that. And the reality is that sometimes the pieces of life don't make sense without hindsight. Sometimes the pieces of life only begin to make sense when we look back. And that's what I want to talk about this morning. And I want to illustrate this from the life of Joseph in the Old Testament. In the book of Genesis, there's about 14 chapters taken up with the life of Joseph. So he's quite a significant figure. Joseph was the 11th of 12 sons. That was a disadvantage because it meant he was kind of the bottom of the pile. But there's a bigger disadvantage for Joseph because he's actually his father's favorite. And when you're an obvious favorite, that's at the expense of the other brothers not liking you that much. One of the reasons that Joseph was the favorite is that Joseph's mum was the second wife of his father. He had 10 of his sons were born to his first wife. He had another wife, and there was two sons born, and Joseph was the eldest of those two. And he became the favorite of his father because there was no question that his mother was his father's favorite as well. So it says that his brothers hated him. Now, there was all this favoritism was shown to him, even to the point where while the other boys were sent out to work, Joseph would stay at home with his dad and didn't have to go to work. And his dad did things like made him this beautiful jacket, you know, the amazing Technicolor dream coat. Interesting. One day, the other boys are out working and they get home from work and Joseph says, "Hey, listen, guys, while you're at work today, I had a dream, and it's a really interesting dream, in the middle of my afternoon nap while you guys are working. Had a dream. Really, do you want to hear the dream? And they probably thought, here we go. And so it went something like this. In the dream, we were all counting sheaves of corn. We all had sheaves of corn. And suddenly, my sheaf of corn stood upright and your sheaves of corn bowed down. You bowed down around my sheaf of corn. So there's mine standing up and yours are all bowing down. That's a pretty good dream, isn't it? And it says they hated him all the more. Well, another time, they came home from working in the field and he says, hey guys, while you guys are out working in the field and just having my afternoon nap, because I was pretty tired. And I had another dream. And this one was really, really interesting as well. Because in this dream, there was the sun and there was the moon and then there was 11 stars. That's kind of all you guys. And there was another star, which was my star. And all the 11 stars bowed down and the moon bowed down and the sun bowed down and kind of worshipped my star. What do you think about that dream, brothers? Now, apparently the whole family got angry, including their father, about that one. Now, all the brothers then decided we haven't had enough of the brat. So they conspired against him. In fact, they wanted to kill him, but Reuben, the eldest brother, said, no, let's make some money out of him. And so there came a day when Joseph was going out to bring food to the boys out in the field, and they kidnapped him and decided to sell him to slave traders. And there were some Ishmaelites passing through, and so they sold him as a slave to the Ishmaelites, and they traveled across the Sinai Desert and into Egypt. In Egypt, he was auctioned there, and he was bought by the highest bidder, and it was a guy named Potiphar. Now, there was a problem for the boys because they had explained to their father where Joseph was, so part of the whole plan was, well, let's take this beautiful coat, tear it to shreds, cover it in animal blood, go home and say, oh, look, Dad, Joseph's kind of vanished, but we found the coat, and it's not looking real good. And it tells us that his father mourned and mourned and mourned and mourned and mourned. And interestingly, it says the brothers wept with him, which means they were really, really good actors. And it tells us that Joseph's father, Jacob, just mourned essentially for years, mourned his dead son. So in Egypt, Potiphar was pretty impressed with this young slave, this young guy, made him head of his household. But the problem was Mrs. Potiphar was just as impressed with him as Mr. Potiphar was, but for different reasons. And so Mrs. Potiphar tried to seduce him and called him into her room and asked him to lay with her. And he didn't. Now, this is pretty cool for a 17-year-old under such circumstances to turn around and run. But as he ran, she grabbed a hold of his coat. So she wasn't real happy. So Mr. Potiphar comes home and she accuses Joseph of attempting to rape her. And so with that news, he believed his wife and Joseph was thrown in prison. At this point, Joseph, an innocent young guy, was in prison for about 13 years. About 10 years into that time in prison, there was two guys in there with him. One was a baker to Pharaoh and the other one was a butler to Pharaoh. And they found themselves in prison. One day, these two guys are particularly sad and he says, what's the problem? And they said, well, we've just been having these dreams and we just don't know what the dream means. Joseph says, well, this could be your lucky day because God has given me the ability to interpret dreams. So if you tell me the dream, I can tell you the meaning of the dream. So these guys shared their dream with him. And the butler said this, listen, I had a dream And I saw a vine with three branches on it, and these branches had budded and blossomed and ripened into grapes, and I squeezed the grapes, and the juice came into Pharaoh's cup, and I gave it to Pharaoh, and that was my dream. And the baker said, I had a dream too. And I dreamed that I had three baskets of bread on my head, and this was for Pharaoh, but the birds came and they were eating the bread out of the basket on the top of my head. And Joseph said, well, let me tell you the meaning of your dreams. And he says to the baker, listen, those three baskets represent 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh is going to hang you on a tree and the birds are going to come and eat your flesh. I'm not sure what the baker felt about that. He probably thought, thanks. He had better news for the butler. He said, in 3 days, Pharaoh will restore you to your position and you will serve him once again as his private cupbearer, and you will serve him wine, the juice from the grapes of the vine. And butler, when that happens, because it is going to happen, when that happens, please remember me to Pharaoh so that I might be released. Well, the butler got his job back and the baker was hung, just as Joseph had said. But when the butler got back into Pharaoh's service, he forgot all about Joseph. And so Joseph is left sitting in prison for another 2 years. After 2 years, Pharaoh himself started having dreams. And he had one particular recurring dream where he was sitting by the Nile River, and out of the Nile River came 7 fat cows, and then followed by that was 7 lean cows, and the lean cows ate the 7 fat cows. And then he also had another recurring dream where there was these sheaves of corn and the ears of corn, and it was one was very, very, shriveled and not healthy. And the other was very, very healthy and ripe and plump. And what would happen is that on the good stalk, the good grain, the shriveled head of grain on the other would come and eat it up. Anyway, this was the reoccurring dream that Pharaoh continued to have, and he would call in his wise men and they go, well, we got no idea what that means at all. The butler's listening in and he remembers back in prison a couple of years ago, just before I was released, there was a guy in prison who could accurately interpret dreams. You need to call him in. And so they bring him in. Joseph stands before Pharaoh. They'd cleaned him up, put clothes on him, all nice and tidy. Joseph says to Pharaoh here, Genesis 41 and 16, and I love what he says, I cannot do it, Joseph replied to Pharaoh, but God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires. And then he explains to Pharaoh what God showed him, and he says, basically the two dreams mean exactly the same thing. You are going to experience 7 years of plenty. The rains will be good. The crops will come in. It will be a time of great abundance. But that will be immediately followed by 7 years of famine, 7 years of drought. And if you do not, in the 7 years of plenty, manage your resources and store up grain and make provision for the 7 years of drought that will follow, the land will be ruined. We pick it up from verse 37. The plan seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his officials. So Pharaoh asked them, can we find anyone like this man, one in whom is the Spirit of God? Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt. What a remarkable journey. So he promotes him to the second highest office in the land, second only to Pharaoh himself. And the Bible tells us he puts a ring on his finger. He gives a house. He gives him a wife. And Joseph is now 30 years of age. It's 13 years since his brothers sold him into slavery. Well, the 7 years of abundance followed, and the land produced plenty, and they built storehouses, and they built barns, and they had to keep building and building and building to hold all the grain that they would hold in surplus. And in those 7 years, Joseph had two sons. And he gave them very interesting names, very significant names. He called the first one Manasseh, which means God has made me forget all my troubles. And the second one he called Ephraim, which means God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. Now, this is only halfway through the story, but he has named his two sons after the two defining things in Joseph's life up to that point, troubles and sufferings. They are the things that have defined him right up until now. And so he names his boys after that. And then after the 7 years of plenty, the 7 years of famine hit, and everything in Egypt was fine because their barns were full. But nearby in the land of Canaan, where his family were, the famine had hit them very, very hard as well. They had no advance warning, and so the food had begun to run out. And 2 years into the famine, Joseph gets this message saying, there are some men from Canaan who have come to buy food. Would you see them? And Joseph said, yes, I will. And into his presence walk his brothers. First time he has seen them for 22 years. And they bowed down before him. And Joseph's thinking, oh, this is a familiar sight. This is a familiar sight. Now, it's a little bit cheeky, but he plays games with them at first. He doesn't tell them who he is. In fact, they head back to Canaan, come back on a second occasion. And in Genesis 45, they're in front of him, and he tells the servants to leave, closes the door behind them. And when that happened, Joseph said to his brothers in Genesis 45 and 4, come close to me. And when they had done so, he said, I am your brother Joseph, who you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed. Don't be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now, there's been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years, there will be no plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And you've got to get a hold of this, because up until this point, his life had been defined by troubles and suffering. But now, as time has progressed, as he has the advantage of hindsight, he looks back and he sees those things a little bit differently. That those troubles and those sufferings for the last 22 years have actually been under the hand of God. And I love the way he says it in verse 5, you sold me, but God sent me. And here in Egypt, he is now beginning to see a picture that actually has the fingerprints of God all over it. Through his troubles and through his sufferings, he's saying, I can see this coming into focus. I can see the picture a little more completely. And he sends his brothers back home to get their father and to bring them back and to bring all of their families back. There was only about 70 of them. But Pharaoh, being incredibly happy with Joseph, gives to his family this very fertile piece of land on the banks of the Nile, a place called Goshen. And they live there for 17 years until their father Jacob finally died. And after he died, it was his wish that he would be buried back in Canaan. So in accordance with his wish, they took him back to Canaan to bury him. And when the boys come back to Egypt after burying their father in Canaan, they started getting a bit nervous, because they're thinking to themselves, you know, maybe Joseph was kind to us because Dad was still alive. And now that Dad's gone, maybe he's not going to be so kind anymore and is going to start to get a little bit of revenge. We know that because it says in Genesis 50 and 15, when Joseph's brothers saw that the father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him?" So they sent word to Joseph saying, "Your father left these instructions before he died. He said, this is what you were to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they've committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father." So again, they haven't changed their stripes. They're still conspiring. And so they get with Joseph and said, "Now Joseph, I'm not sure if Dad said this to you just before he died, but he told us, and he told us to tell you that you're to be nice to us and to forgive us and not to exact revenge." And I love what Joseph said in response. Verse 19, Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid." Joseph is now 54 years of age, 37 years since his brothers had sold him as a slave, and he says, "Don't be afraid. You intended to harm me. I know your hearts were wicked. You intended to harm me, but my life has been the disposal of somebody so much bigger than you. And God intended this for good." Okay, let me pause there and ask a question. Was it the will of God for Joseph to be sold into slavery? Because that messes with our heads a little bit. I would suggest no. I mean, were Joseph's brothers having a devotion one morning together, a little Bible study, and they prayed together and they said, "God, what is your will for our lives today?" And God turned up and said, "Glad you asked. I want you to kidnap your brother and sell him into slavery and then go and lie to your father that he was murdered. That's my will for your life today." No, that wasn't the will of God. Their intent was evil. Their hearts were evil. Their intention was evil, but Joseph, in hindsight, sees a redemptive God turning the evil into something positive and something good. Can I hear an amen this morning? And remember, I've been saying through this that God didn't create you to give you something to do. God has something to do, and you and I are born into such a time and place as this, and we are so privileged and called to be a part of a much, much bigger picture. And Joseph is a great example of this. In his later years, with hindsight, Joseph realized this. 55:9, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." So Joseph gets a hold of a picture of what God is doing and realizes this is all part of a much, much greater plan. This has been about the saving of many lives. This is about the preservation of my family. But here's where it gets even so much better, because that was Joseph's perspective, and he can go, "You know what? This is something good. This is about my family being preserved." And what he didn't realize at that point is that still part of a much, 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 much bigger plan than that. It's a good picture, the saving of lives, the preservation of family. But there is a bigger picture than that as well, because his family, who was saved, living in a place called Goshen, just 70 people, would become a nation of over 2 million people called Israel. And so this is a much bigger plan that Joseph probably had very, very little realization of right there. But then there's a much bigger plan than even that as well, because this promise was made to one of Joseph's forefathers, Abraham, that from Abraham would come a nation, and that nation would bless the world. And centuries, centuries later, through the seed of Abraham, would come Jesus, the Messiah. It's all part of Joseph's story. It's all part of the bigger picture that God had drawn Joseph into. And can I respectfully say this morning? Praise God for Joseph's trouble and suffering. Yeah, Not because God is some kind of monster, like a kid with a magnifying glass burning ants and getting some perverse joy out of that. Not at all. But a God who weaves a tapestry, a God who weaves a story out of pain and out of the ill intent of others. Friends, no matter what has happened in your life, I've said this before, God can redeem that. Not just bring you out of that, but redeem that and then wonderfully weave that into a much, much, much bigger story. Remember in part one, I talked about that platitude that we too easily hand out that says, God's got a wonderful plan for your life. And when it goes wrong, we wonder why it hasn't turned out as that pastor told me. He said he had a wonderful plan for my life. What about Joseph? He's in prison for 13 years, waking up every day in prison, an innocent man. This is a wonderful plan God's got for my life. Joseph was part of a wonderful plan, but Joseph wasn't at the center of the plan. God was at the center of plan, and Joseph was brought into that tapestry, into that jigsaw puzzle. Friends, sometimes it is only hindsight that reveals that to us. There's an American philosopher, not a Christian guy, but I love one comment he made. His name was Ralph Emerson. And he said this, believe what the years and centuries say against what the hours and minutes say. Think about that. That's a great statement. Believe what the years and centuries say against what the hours and minutes say. What do the hours and minutes say? Turn on the news and you're suddenly going to feel very insecure. You're going to feel very uneasy and you're going to feel a little bit anxious because that's what the hours and minutes say. They tell us that things are very, very uncertain. What do the years and centuries say? They tell us that a sovereign God is at work. And we belong to a kingdom that is actually unshakable. Can I hear an amen? And when you and I make the mistake of getting all hung up by what the minutes and hours say, we need to stand back and say, God, I thank you that there's a bigger picture going on here. I thank you that your thoughts are not my thoughts, that your ways are not my ways, that you see a much bigger picture than I can ever see. And we've got to start asking ourselves the bigger questions. What are the years and centuries saying? What is it that God is doing? What is it that history tells us, that history demonstrates to us, that ongoing work of God? And right now, right here in this moment, you and I are drawn into that, to be a part of that, called of God and used of God. And friends, we got to get our thoughts and our minds and our perspective and our focus on the bigger picture, not the micro picture, which is me and I am the center of that picture. But no, what is it that God is doing? What are the years and the centuries saying? Because if we live in the minute, if we live in the hour, we're going to be like Joseph. And you'll say, Joseph, what's the defining points of your life? Well, it's trouble and suffering. All I see is trouble and suffering. All I see is trouble and suffering. But when I look at the big picture, as far as the purposes of God are concerned, God is at work, even when we don't understand it in the moment. And we say, God, I'm here. I'm trusting you, as we've said in previous series. I'm not leaning on my own understanding. I'm just trusting you. I'm acknowledging you. I'm surrendering to you. And I know that in the midst of this, you will direct my path. I'll invite the team to come back. Friends, our perspective is often 70 years and 10. That's a human lifespan. God is working to a timetable that is eternal. It's a much, much bigger plan than that. Friends, what is God doing in the world around us that you and I right now are called to be a part of? And I don't know where you are this morning, but let me tell you that God knows you. He knows where you're at. He can redeem even the most painful of circumstances. He can work something for good, that what you intended, that what the devil intended for harm, God will work for something good.